Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the drowning of two brothers in the Kankakee River, the city of Gary is looking to sell its public safety building, Jenny Lindsay reports on school safety, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with Senator Joe Donnelly. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Court records released Thursday paint the father of two boys who drowned in the Kankakee River on Tuesday as a man resigned to his fate. The Times reports, as doctors at Franciscan Health Crown Point worked to save the life of his four-year-old son, Levi, Eric Patilla arrived with his parents at the hospital to speak with Lake County Sheriff's detectives. Detectives saw blood and urine samples from the 34-year-old Thayer man who had been on probation since May for heroin possession. Despite court-ordered addiction and behavior counseling as part of his 18-month suspended sentence in Newton County, Patilla admitted to police that earlier that day he snorted heroin. Patilla tested positive for both heroin and marijuana. According to police records, Patilla tested positive for both heroin and marijuana. It was later that night inside a Lake County police interview room that Patilla was informed that his sons, Evan, 2, and Levi, 4, both of Thayer, were dead. According to the criminal affidavit filed in the case, Patilla acknowledged his heroin use could have been the reason his sons drowned. According to court records, hours earlier, it was a pair of strangers, two men who had gone to the river to fish, who attempted to save the children. The two fishermen called 911 at 4:35 p.m. Tuesday to alert authorities about two men with two young children in the area. The fishermen expressed concern about the children's well-being, both claiming Patilla appeared to be under the influence. According to the affidavit, when one witness asked Patilla what he was on, Patilla allegedly responded he was on, quote, boy, a street term for heroin. One of the fishermen told police he observed a sweaty Patilla doze off several times while trying to bait a hook on a fishing pole shortly before his sons drowned. According to court records, Patilla denied he was falling asleep. The fishermen said they saw the two boys knee-deep in water before the incident. Shortly after, they noticed Patilla dunking himself in and out of the water. The witnesses said it was possible the father was attempting to counteract the effects of heroin. According to the affidavit, after confronting Patilla, the two men were headed back to their camp when they realized they hadn't seen or heard from the two small boys for some time. One of the men went back to look for the boys. As the fisherman approached a bend in the river, he saw four-year-old Levi floating on his back, partially submerged and unresponsive. The affidavit states, as first responders arrived on scene minutes later to take over CPR, Patilla was, quote, running around the parking lot yelling, "Why, God, why?" Patilla's friend, who was in the vehicle for the first half of the incident, voluntarily testified to police and said Patilla was taking the boys to the river to show them where they were going to fish at a later time. The witness said he was not aware of Patilla's drug use. He said he left the vehicle and ran to the scene when he heard Patilla shouting. When he was pressed again on Eric Patilla's drug use, the friend stated he wanted an attorney. According to court records, Patilla's friend also disputed claims it was the fisherman who performed CPR on the children. Patilla was arrested Tuesday night on suspicion of felony neglect of a dependent resulting in death. Patilla was formally charged Thursday afternoon in Lake County Criminal Court with two counts of neglect of a dependent resulting in death, a level one felony.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
An Indiana woman who says her husband died fighting for the Islamic State movement in Syria is accused of providing support to the group. Federal prosecutors say 32-year-old Samantha El-Hassani of Elkhart was charged Wednesday with conspiring to provide material support to ISIS and aiding and abetting individuals in providing material support. She is accused of providing tactical gear and funds to two Islamic State fighters. El-Hassani's attorney, Thomas Durkin, called the charges, quote, wrong-headed and cruel, and said she's, quote, a victim of her jihadist husband who should be receiving treatment rather than incarceration. She's accused of providing tactical gear and funds to two Islamic State fighters. El-Hassani told PBS's Frontline and the BBC in April that her Moroccan husband tricked her in 2015 into traveling with their four children to Syria, where he died fighting for the Islamic State.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. The state-appointed manager of the Gary Community School Corporation told state officials this week the district faces less of a deficit than it did a year ago. The annual operating deficit is now estimated at $15 million. That's $7 million less than the original deficit. Gary Emergency Manager Peggy Hinckley closed a school and cut staff to reduce spending. She also created a middle school by reconfiguring grades at the district's 9 schools. She hopes the middle school will attract new families. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The Gary City Council has voted to explore the option of selling and leasing back its public safety building in an effort to raise funds to balance the city's budget. The vote Tuesday was 7-1 in favor of the effort. Although no buyer has lined up yet, Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson said banks have expressed some confidence in the future success of the sale leaseback. The building in question was a hospital that closed in 1995. Former Mayor Scott King used $15 million in casino revenues to renovate a part of the building. It reopened in 2003 as the public safety building and is home to the Gary Police Department and provides space for the Gary City Court and the clerk's office. Gary adopted a $54 million budget for this year. It is expected to collect about $30 million in property taxes. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. President Donald Trump will rally supporters in Indiana next week as Republicans seek to unseat vulnerable Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly. Trump's campaign announced Wednesday that he will hold a rally in Evansville on August 30th. He previously appeared in the state in May. The campaign says Trump will talk about economic policies and stress his support for the GOP candidate. Donnelly is facing wealthy Republican businessman Mike Braun in what is viewed as one of the nation's most competitive Senate races. The White House has said Trump is aiming to spend more than 40 days on the campaign trail between the beginning of August and the November 6 midterms as he hopes to best his predecessor's travel schedules. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Police in Northwest Indiana say an attack on a Catholic priest has been forwarded to the FBI as a possible hate crime because the assailant referred to reports of clergy sex abuse involving children. Maryville Detective Commander Jeff Rice says the Reverend Basil John Huskell was assaulted Monday morning at St. Michael Byzantine Catholic Church. Rice says the 64-year-old priest was taken to a hospital for treatment. His condition was unknown Tuesday. Pope Francis issued a letter Monday condemning priestly sexual abuse and its cover-up. Also, a Pennsylvania grand jury reported last week about 300 priests abused at least 1,000 children over the past 70 years. Huskell isn't named in the report. Gary Diocesan spokeswoman Desi Bozak tells the Post Tribune clergy are aware of the attack and will take precautions. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. University of Notre Dame President Father John Jenkins spoke on the recent child sexual abuse scandals rocking the Catholic Church at the beginning of the opening Mass of the Holy Spirit on Tuesday. The Mass is to welcome students to a new year at Notre Dame. Father Jenkins said he would use the Mass to do that, but said he, quote, could not ignore what had come out of Pennsylvania. Jenkins said that the clergy involved in the abuse gave good priests a bad name, saying that, quote, commitment can seem so tarnished, so soaked in filth by those who so badly abused it. Jenkins said he agreed with Pope Francis' statement to stand by the victims and hold the perpetrators accountable. He also stated he supports Bishop Kevin Rhodes releasing the names of clergy in the Diocese of Fort Wayne, South Bend that have been credibly accused of abuse. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The Indiana Democratic Party Wednesday filed an ethics complaint against Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun days after Republicans filed one against Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the complaint alleges Braun didn't properly file information about a loan he made to his campaign.
Campaign finance law says candidates must report loans of more than $1,000 to the Federal Election Commission within 48 hours. The Indiana Democratic Party says one such loan, $250,000 Mike Braun gave to himself in late April, wasn't filed within that window. The Braun campaign disputes this. It sent a copy of the required form to Indiana Public Broadcasting, which shows the reported loan timestamped within that 48-hour deadline. The FEC's website doesn't reflect that, but likely due to a technological error. One such 48-hour report on the site is incomplete. Basically, it looks like a garbled fax, and the parts of the form that are readable appear to match up with the form the Braun campaign shared with Indiana Public Broadcasting. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A South Bend abortion clinic's bid to secure a license from the state may turn on its connection to other abortion clinics around the country. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on an appeal hearing this week after the state denied the clinic's application earlier this year.
Whole Woman's Health Alliance, a nonprofit run by a board of directors, wants to open an abortion clinic in South Bend, but the state denied its application because of what it said was incomplete and inaccurate information. The state points to another group, Whole Woman's Health LLC. That's a for-profit business that also runs abortion clinics. The LLC's owner, Amy Hagstrom-Miller, sits on the board of directors at the Alliance, and the LLC provides marketing and public relations for the Alliance. But Whole Woman's Health Alliance says it's not connected to clinics owned by the LLC, which is why its application didn't list those clinics. The state disagrees, though it didn't ask the Alliance to further clarify that relationship before it denied the license. There's no timetable for a decision on the group's appeal. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Schools could have another option to fund safety measures if a state lawmaker gets his way. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports one member of the General Assembly wants to let schools ask local taxpayers for money to support school safety efforts.
The state gives districts options to fund security or safety measures, but State Senator Travis Holdman says it's not enough. He plans to file legislation that would add another option. He wants to let schools propose school safety referenda on local ballots. Schools can already use money from operations referenda for safety costs, but Holdman says a school safety-specific option would help focus those efforts.
And it focuses specifically on school safety so that other issues and other projects can't get commingled with that or mixed up in that.
Holdman says if his bill makes it through the next legislative session, schools could propose safety referenda as early as fall 2019. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A museum official who questioned Star Wars actor Adam Driver's recent comments about remembering frequent Ku Klux Klan rallies during his youth in northern Indiana now acknowledges he was wrong. Driver made the comments during a USA Today interview about his role in the new movie Black Klansman. Travis Childs of the History Museum in South Bend was quoted Monday saying the actor was likely misremembering his childhood in nearby Mishawaka. Childs, who moved to the area in 1999, said he hadn't adequately researched the Klan's history in the area before commenting on Driver's assertions. Childs said he regrets that people outside Indiana who read about the state's Klan history will develop a negative impression. He goes on to say, quote, "You can't lie, though. You can't deny that they were here. Indiana was the backbone of the KKK for a lot of years in the 20th century." According to the South Bend Tribune, local Klan members and rallies were indeed frequent when Driver, 34, was growing up. Six men claiming to be Klansmen attacked a black couple and their baby arriving home in 1992, less than 2 years after Driver moved to Mishawaka from California at age seven. The men were later sent to prison for their crimes. Four local white men claiming affiliation with a hate group called the White Brotherhood set out to find and rob a black woman in 1993, killing Kathy Long in the process and drawing media coverage. They were also sentenced to prison, according to the newspaper. The Tribune also reports that five KKK
rallies occurred in the area between 1993 and 2001, in addition to two KKK protests in 1998 when a white student was forced to remove a shirt with a racial slur. The South Bend Times reports that the area was also known for Wilton Loy, who claimed to be the head of the National Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Loy's Osceola Farm was the site for more than 15 rallies and similar events between 2000 and 2007, including the annual White Pride Fest. Historians estimate that nearly a third of Indiana's native-born white Protestant men were Klan members at one point. More than 30 hate groups operate in the state today, with three of them affiliated with the Klan, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. More than 30 hate groups operate in the state today, three of them affiliated with the Klan, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Environmental Protection Agency has announced its rule that would replace Obama's Clean Power Plan. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, officials with Indiana's coal industry are encouraged by the proposal.
While the Clean Power Plan focused more on reducing greenhouse gas emissions through renewable energy, this new rule, called Affordable Clean Energy, would instead work to make coal-fired power plants more efficient. And Indiana Coal Council President Bruce Stevens says more efficient plants often run longer. And that could be a game changer for Indiana utilities that are planning to shutter their coal plants.
Now they can go back and revisit and determine if the coal plant running into the future is more economical.
The new rule would also allow states to come up with their own standards for greenhouse gas emissions from coal plants. Because Indiana passed a law that prohibits the state from making environmental rules more stringent than federal ones without a review, it's unclear what Indiana's emissions plan would look like. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A bill passed during the 2018 legislative session requires public high schools in Indiana to offer a computer science elective starting in 2021. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emily Cyborg reports, smaller school districts can find compliance more challenging.
Kevin Smith has been on the job as Covington School Corporation superintendent for 45 days. His desk is covered in neat stacks of paper, notebooks, and binders, and a school walkie-talkie.
I don't like it this way, but it is what it is for today.
Covington sits near the Illinois border in Fountain County. It's the county seat, with a population of about 2,500. Smith was previously a principal in towns such as downstate Switz City, so he's used to education in less populated places. But for small towns with limited resources, it can be a big challenge to implement the state's new computer science requirements.
The long and short of it is, look, to say that it's not a challenge to be able to meet the needs of everyone, it is. Well, to me, that's going to be true whether it's a larger school or a smaller school.
At the high school level, Covington currently offers classes in web design and in what it calls digital responsibility, essentially a computer catch-all. To comply with the new legislation, the corporation's schools have to offer at least one of the courses on a list provided by the state, which range from intro to computer science to AP computer science principles. The state won't mandate how many students take those classes, just that they're available. But finding instructors may be the first challenge.
I'm the only technology teacher at our high school.
Craig Sauer's desk faces a classroom lined with 24 computers.
Each kid has a one-on-one device. They all have Chromebooks, so there's no shortness of technology. There's just a shortness of space, and there's a shortness of me is what becomes the problem.
So what's a small school corporation like Covington to do if it needs more teachers trained in CS? Hiring additional full-time staff is not in the budget for many districts. The Senate bill does offer some professional development funding for teachers to learn computer science, but that could mean making an art or a home ec teacher a part-time CS instructor, and thus having them teach fewer classes in their specialty. Karen Jung is the president of NextTech, an Indianapolis nonprofit instructing teachers across the state on how to implement computer science in K-12 classrooms. She says teachers who don't have a technology background can feel intimidated.
I think one of the historical challenges, and it's not specific to just Indiana, but is helping folks to understand what computer science is and is not, and why every student should have access to it.
Jung says many people see computer science simply as coding, programming, or software development. But there's a bigger picture.
Computer science is all about the fundamentals of problem solving, creativity, creating algorithms, how to solve problems that really transcend any specific programming language or any specific type of technology and really any subject, and prepare a student for success post-secondary, regardless of what career path they go down.
In 2017, 115 of Indiana's 525 high schools, that's just more than one-fifth, offered computer science courses. That number will need to more than quadruple by the 2021 deadline. In a conference call, Indiana Department of Education spokesman Adam Baker says the DOE understands the challenges school districts will face, especially ones like Covington, where funds might be limited.
I mean, that's one of the things that we, you know, don't take lightly, but one of the things we enjoy is working with districts to kind of figure out those solutions.
Back in the Covington superintendent's office, Kevin Smith is realistic. 45 days into his job, he doesn't know the answer, but he's confident there will be a plan by the deadline.
We may not see what it's going to be sitting here today, but we'll get the right answer at the right time.
Covington has the next two school years to find a solution. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Seiberg.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
After a student and her teacher were shot at Noblesville West Middle School at the end of last school year, the summer was spent on renewed conversations about school safety in Indiana. The state offered to buy handheld metal detectors for any districts that wanted them, and superintendents began taking a hard look at their protocols. But, as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Charlotte Tuggle reports, experts say there's still a lack of coordination and the state may not have closed many security loopholes.
Inside Lafayette School Corporation Superintendent Les Huddle's office, 30 handheld metal detector wands are still in their boxes. Unwrapping one, he admits the district doesn't quite know what to do with them yet.
Until there's a plan in place and we reviewed the legal aspects of it.
After the Noblesville school shooting in May, the state unveiled its new program, buying one free metal detector wand for every 250 Hoosier students. Huddle says he's grateful for the new tool, but when it comes to using them effectively, the state didn't offer much guidance.
Kids are wearing belts, they're wearing jewelry, they're watches, they're carrying iPads, cell phones, all those things now. And it's going to take some type of common sense planning for us to implement this in some manner.
But even with a plan in place, those metal detector wands may not be as effective as they look, says one school safety expert.
Ken Trump, president of National School Safety and Security Services in Cleveland, Ohio, no relation to the president.
Trump says there are ways around the metal detectors. For example, if they're used every morning, a student could stow a weapon during an after-hours activity. Or if there's a group of students waiting outside to be screened, they may be targeted by a shooter there.
It's security theater. In many cases, particularly in a school environment, it gives that perception of increased security. It's certainly a good political grab for legislators and government officials who want to show that they're doing something and something that's physical, tangible.
Some superintendents also question the necessity of the new state-issued tool. West Lafayette schools did not request any metal detector wands. Here's Superintendent Rocky Killian.
No amount of technology is going to tell you what a person's getting ready to do. It will only show you what a person has done.
So to focus on the preventative side of emergency preparedness, Killian says he believes the best practice is intangible.
We work very hard to help staff identify things because human intel is actually, and it seems to be the most important aspect to school security. If you see something, say something.
School safety expert Ken Trump says he'd add to that.
See something, say something, and then do something. We need to train our frontline educators, on our parents, and our kids on what do you do when you see something, how do you say something, and then to those who are told something, what do you do?
A statewide school safety recommendations report released earlier this summer emphasizes increased communication. Indiana Department of Homeland Security Director Brian Langley was one of its authors.
We really, again, want to make sure this report is tactical, strategic, but again, it's a living and breathing document, too.
Langley says the report's proposed projects include a statewide school tip line and an online information hub.
Because what we found that many schools aren't aware of some of the programs that exist, and it's not their fault. It's just the day and age, there's so much happening, and there's so many things that you have to do as a school to be prepared.
But what Lafayette Superintendent Les Huddle says is one of the drawbacks, state officials making possible solutions available, not telling schools how to use them, Langley cites as one of the benefits of the plan. The report also stresses the need for more mental health resources, though Langley points out that issue affects more than just school children. So, in the first case, the state has allocated resources, but isn't saying how to use them. In the second, even if schools had a plan, in many cases the resources aren't there, nor is the money to afford them. All the while, most Indiana parents are left to do little more than hope their kids are safer as this school year begins.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Universities across the country are experiencing dips in the number of international students studying at their institutions. It's led to speculation about what could be causing the drops. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports, leaders say, regardless, the trend needs to be reversed.
As you drive down a main strip in Terre Haute, American flags line the streets as far as the eye can see. But several weeks ago, dozens of other national flags took flight alongside them. Around 30 flags blow in the wind as they line the front of an apartment complex.
Saudi Arabia is there. We have a lot of students from Saudi Arabia living here in the building.
That's Mike Ellis. He owns Center City Apartments, where nearly all 33 units are rented out by international students studying at Indiana State University.
I felt like by flying the flags of the various nations where many of the students come from, that it was sending a message to those students that we not only want them here, but we are welcoming to them being here.
Ellis says his message is in response to what he describes as unwelcoming language directed at people coming to the U.S. from other countries. It's something state education leaders believe could be contributing to a decrease in international students studying here. According to an analysis of U.S. Department of Homeland Security data, international enrollment dropped by about 4% between 2016 and 2017 nationwide. Indiana's numbers are following a similar trend. ISU's international student enrollment has dropped to just over 600 students, compared to more than 900 in 2015. And Indiana University's numbers are also taking a turn. John Wilkerson is the director of international admissions at IU. He says the numbers had been growing steadily for the last decade.
This past year was the first year, I believe since 2006, that we've seen a decline in international student enrollment.
That's something that IU student Adeline Iskandar Zukarnain is worried about. She's the president of the Malaysian Student Association. The number of members in the association dropped from 100 last semester to less than 50 this fall.
That is quite concerning for us because we still want to keep our student association going, but if we didn't receive any new students, that's a problem.
Earlier this year, IU President Michael McRobbie issued a scathing letter calling this trend tremendously problematic. He points to a number of factors, including anti-immigration sentiments. Wilkerson says other factors include increased global competition and some places offering clearer paths to citizenship or residency, and there's also safety concerns. Purdue is one university where international enrollment remains stable. In fact, the institution is in the top 10 in the country for enrollment. International Programs Dean Michael Brzezinski says it's a point of pride for the school. He says Purdue has worked hard to embrace international students on campus, and the benefits are wide-reaching.
There's not a job out there nowadays that doesn't require some aspect of that, what I'm going to just call intercultural competency. What better way to train people for that than to have that microcosm of the world here on our campus?
Not to mention, international students in 2016 contributed $1 billion to the state. Although Wilkerson says a number of factors are to fault for the changes in enrollment, IU refuses to take the wait-and-see approach.
Being proactively engaging with students, making sure that we are sharing with them the message of the community, doing that in a way that is candid and accurate.
And Ellis says he's hoping to start a conversation in his community.
I don't care where they're from. I don't care if they're black or brown or white or red or yellow. Everyone should be welcome in this country, and I can assure you, from my perspective, they are.
He's encouraging residents to reach out if they want to see their flag flying on his building, even if it means wrapping the whole complex. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
IU Board of Trustees recently approved a new $17.5 million International Student Center that will be located in the heart of the campus. Wilkerson says it will enhance the university's commitment to international learning. Construction is expected to start next spring.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Senator Joe Donnelly.
U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly spoke with us earlier today about several issues that he has been dealing with his colleagues on Capitol Hill, including the alarming rate of suicides in Indiana and across the country. I understand that you've got a bipartisan bill going that would deal with suicide hotlines and making some improvements in that. Please tell us about that.
Yeah, we were able to get it passed, and the president signed it. Orrin Hatch, my Republican friend from Utah, and I worked together to pass legislation that would allow the FCC to look at putting in place a three-digit suicide hotline number, much like a 911. And what this number would do is somebody could call it, and there'd be a person on the other end who could help talk them through a difficult situation, try to find them help. And so we've seen very large at-risk groups. You know, some of the most at-risk are teenagers and veterans as well. And so, you know, we'll be helping all parts of our communities, but in particular young people and veterans with this.
I know that the veterans hotline is a much longer number, and you have to go through sometimes couple different operators. Would this in turn make it a lot easier, not only for veterans themselves, but for the VA to be able to help deal with this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The whole idea, for instance, you know, is to punch in, say, 711, and you're connected. That's it. Yeah. And that's the whole premise behind this, is to make it simpler and easier to have someone to talk to and to try to provide help.
Speaking of the military, I know that you had an opportunity here last week to help lead 48 other senators along in urging that the Trump administration not abandon its duty to be able to protect service members and their families under the Military Lending Act. And we've had some very sad stories come out on NPR about the kind of impact that predatory lenders can have on military and their family members. Tell us more about the efforts that you're making on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, the efforts we're making are to do exactly what you talked about, which is to protect our service members. We had the Military Lending Act in place that helps protect service members, helps set maximum interest rates that can be charged to them. For instance, in a lot of our bases, if you go right off base, there are payday lenders and similar places located just across the street. And what we're trying to do is make sure that the protections that have been put in place continue. And the administration is actually looking at suspending the Military Lending Act, the parts of it that protect our service members, and we're fighting back to make sure we can keep those in place.
Now, finally, Senator Donnelly, we know that you had an opportunity, along with a few other senators, not many, but a few other, to talk recently with the Supreme Court nominee, Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Tell us how things went in that discussion and how things stand on how you feel about his confirmation as a possible member of the Supreme Court.
Well, I've had a process in place, which is to review his decisions, to watch his speeches and read his articles that he's written, then to meet with him, which we just did, and then to watch, you know, and take away all the information from the Judiciary Committee hearings with Judge Kavanaugh. And so we're in the middle of that process right now, but the meeting was good. It was something that I wanted to check his record, his experience that he had, his impartiality, talk to him about health care and precedent, judicial independence, and so it was a very solid visit.
Well, Senator Donnelly, thank you for spending time with us to talk about some of these important issues. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you again soon, we hope.
Thank you. It's my privilege.
Bye now.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.